Welcome, 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 beloved listeners, to another week of the Little Wireless program. And tonight, three stories about Jobs. No, not the sainted or perhaps problematic Steve, but Jobs as in lowercase j. We're off to Dilly's shortly to see how proposed new media laws will make the job of journalism, the jobs of journalists, much more difficult. Jobs are a major problem in South Australia, and they'll feature in our election watch coming up on the South Australian election. And then we can look at the future of jobs. And you will learn, because I know what's going to happen, because I've just been reading the notes, that the notion of a nation producing jobs is getting pretty old-fashioned. It's going to be big cities, certain powerhouse cities like San Francisco, London, Rio, and to some extent, Sydney. But first of all, let's go to East Timor, where proposed media laws are causing great concern. Rather than ensuring freedom of the press, as the government states, the new laws may have the opposite effect. Now, joining me to discuss this is Charlie Shiner. Charlie is a researcher with the Now Hammertoek Institute for Development, Monitoring and Analysis in Timor-Leste. Now Hammertoek was invited by the parliamentary committee looking at the new laws to present and discuss its views, and he's going to share them with us. Thanks, Charlie. Welcome to our Little Wireless program.
Thank you, Philip. It's great to be here.
Charlie, does East Timor need new media laws?
Well, I think there's a difference between what's needed and what's being proposed. Under the civil law system that Timor-Leste inherited from Portugal and Indonesia, there does seem to be, and this for Australians and probably for me as an American, it's a little hard to get my head around, they seem to feel like there needs to be a law about everything, that a constitutional guarantee of freedom of the press is not enough, that there needs to be some kind of law specifying what freedom of the press is. But the reality is that Timor-Leste has now been an independent sovereign nation for nearly 12 years without a media law, and the press is functioning just fine. I mean, I'm not saying it's perfect. Journalists certainly have limitations in capacity and resources. But in terms of freedom and censorship and a wide variety of different views being expressed, that works very well.
Well, Charlie, just casting my eye over the proposals, it's almost as though a journalist will have to have a license to practice up there. And if you're a new journalist, if you belong to the new world of emerging media, life's going to be pretty impossible. Can you run the proposals past us?
Sure. One of the things that we're most concerned about this new law is that it creates a status of journalist and people that are only on a list that's established by an organization called a press council. Would be journalists, and they would have the rights of freedom of expression and access to information that, according to the Constitution, every person should have. And a journalist is someone who's employed by a commercial media organization, who works full-time, who has been through certain training, and who has been licensed by this press council. So that people like, for example, the organization I work for, which does what the law defines as journalistic activities, which is to collect, analyze, and disseminate information to the public. We do that all the time on our website, on our blog, and in other ways. But we're not a for-profit commercial entity, so we wouldn't qualify as journalists under this law. And I myself, as I'm not a Timor-Leste citizen, even though I've lived there for more than 12 years, lived here, I should say, for more than 12 years, the law says only Timorese citizens can be journalists, which we also think is a major error.
I can remember when I was welcomed to East Timor with open arms by our old friend Ramos Horta and by Janana. But under the new system, foreign journalists will be viewed with great suspicion.
Well, under the new system, journalists working for foreign media outlets, such as yourself, would have to get permission from a government agency or a government official to practice journalism in Timor-Leste. But you couldn't be, as an Australian national, you couldn't work for a Timor-Leste publication. You couldn't be a licensed journalist here. You could only report for a foreign entity and I think probably only temporarily. The history of this country, as Australians know very well, A large contribution to the struggle for independence was made by foreign journalists, by the Balabo Five, who are probably the best known, and Roger East and others, Indonesian, New Zealand journalists who were killed later on during the struggle. Max Dahl, who fortunately is still alive, but contributed a tremendous amount to this country's independence. All of those people are basically excluded from their profession.
And of course, as I know your organization is pointing out, Charlie, a great many of the journalists or the journalistic activity which helped in Timor-Leste's struggle for freedom was independent and unofficial media.
Yeah, we actually put a few pages on our website from a newspaper called Timor-Leste that Fretilin published in 1975 before Indonesia invaded. It was an unofficial, unlicensed press. It didn't have the Portuguese government's approval. And the people who wrote for it were people like José Ramos Horta and Xanana Gusmão, were not licensed professional journalists. So I think that there's a change, and I guess it's a change that comes from, maybe it's from some of the people in government knowing how powerful free, independent, unfettered journalism can be to upset abuses of power. And they're maybe a little bit afraid of that. And so this law tends to follow more of the Suharto-era Indonesian model of creating a press council, lets the media owners and a few representatives of professional journalists financed by the government, and it then decides who's allowed to be a journalist and who's not. Of course, those Indonesian laws were written 30-some years ago, before there were Facebook and internet and blogs and all the other things that people use now. And also, I guess in Indonesia at that time, they didn't have a tradition of freelance journalists, part-time journalists, but all of those kinds of things would be excluded, would be disallowed by this law.
But Charlie, it seems to me an exercise in futility. It won't work. It can't work. The world is so different now.
Yes, that's certainly true. I visited China, Beijing, about 6 months ago, and I tried to access Facebook from Beijing and found that it was blocked. And then I asked a Timorese student who I was staying with in his apartment. I said, "You know, how do you do Facebook?" And he said, "Oh, there's all this software. You download this, you install this." It took 2 seconds to get around the Chinese government's attempt to block Facebook. You know, as you said, it's basically impossible for governments to prevent this kind of communication.
Charlie, tell me this. Are the journalists in East Timor who will be licensed entirely happy with this proposal, or is there internal opposition about it?
I think there's a division. The owners of the for-profit media seem to be happy with it, of the newspaper owners and the government television and radio stations, because it reinforces a monopoly on journalistic work for them. Some of the journalists, there are two associations, the Timor-Leste Journalists Association and the Timor-Leste Press Union, they've both made statements against this law. They're very opposed to the idea that journalists have to be licensed by a press council. So like in everything, there's a division between the bosses and the workers.
Yeah. Well, Charlie, look, thank you very much for that. Charlie Shiner, he's a researcher with the now Hammertoek Institute for Development, Monitoring and Analysis in Timor-Leste. And I think we'll be monitoring developments as the story develops. So I suspect I'll be talking to Charlie again. And now coming up on LNL Election Watch in South Australia, where jobs are once again an issue. I've just been tweeting about the story, and I noticed that Anthony Green was coming in to participate. Well, he's actually on the blower. And I made the point that Anthony is so prescient about what happens in elections that perhaps we don't need to have them. We can just follow his instructions. I'm also joined by Dr. Hayden Manning, who's Associate Professor, School of Social and Policy Studies at Flinders University. And let us set this up by reminding ourselves that the first priority for whoever wins government this weekend in South Australia will be to boost employment, or to try to boost employment in the state. South Australia has become what the Americans like to call a rust belt state, full of industries that have passed their use-by date, and car manufacturing, of course, is the big example. Treasurer Joe Hockey said recently the way to get more and better jobs was to make Australia a more attractive place. For Joe, that means reducing the cost of business and more flexible employment conditions. But, it's not the way it's going to be working. Anyway, I'm sorry, let me just shuffle some papers. And here we go. So, South Australia, big problems, and election week looks at it, and my first questions go to you, Anthony. By all predictions, Labor's last remaining state government, well, in both South Australia and Tassie, are about to slide out of office. But you tweeted that the South Australian election calculator produces a hung parliament.
That's if you use a strict uniform swing. The Rann government got back last time with one of the more extraordinary election results I've ever seen. There was an 8.5% swing against Labor across the state, but it didn't occur in the marginal seats. The Labor Party should have lost 7 seats under a 7% swing, and it only lost 2 of them. These 2 most marginal seats actually swung to Labor, that Labor managed to so concentrate its campaign on its key marginal seats, there was no swing in the seats that would have cost it government, but big swings everywhere else that wouldn't cost it government. Now, that's what you're coming off at this election. I can't see how government can do that 2 elections in a row. Some of that sandbagging that was done last time will probably unpick itself at this election. So I think there is a long-term problem for the Liberal Party in South Australia that the state's geography sees their vote rather bottled up in country electorates. But I still don't think it's anything that's going to save the Labor Party on the Saturday.
How do you find that line of argument, Hayden Manning?
Oh, look, I totally agree with Anthony on that. Look, momentum's just all the Liberal Party's way, Philip. It has been really since Stephen Marshall took the leadership, and of course many listeners won't know his name. Many South Australians haven't known his name until the campaign. He was elected to Parliament in 2010, spent the first 18 months on the backbench. He then became a shadow, shortly after deputy, and then in February last year, he's the leader, albeit of a party that has been rather divided and bitter and, if you like, even twisted internally for too many years in this state. However, he's presented a united front in the last 12 months. All the opinion polls point toward a steady improvement in the Liberal vote. And I'd add as well, I think the important ingredient here in the mix in 2014 compared to 2010, the Libs have pre-selected, I reckon, a better crop of candidates. Plus, the average Liberal...
But that you can do that, can't you, when there's a certain amount of optimism?
Yes,
people,
yes, exactly.
People put their hands up.
Yeah, when there's a whiff of government in the air, which, as I say, that's certainly been the air. Look, there's a host of other reasons. Labor's had its problems. We might get to those in a moment. But that's right. On the ground campaigning, and, the people I talk to, former students who are working on the Liberal parent campaign, working on the Labor campaign, the message coming out, the Libs have got a spring in their step, whiff of victory. They're working harder. A bit down in the dumps in the Labor camp. It's summer hanging off, maybe a hung parliament. Can't see that myself. Then, of course, the question becomes, could it be a bigger defeat?
Okay, before I go back to Anthony, can you tell us about the trench?
Oh, look, the trench. Oh, dear, the trench. This was something a couple of young journos rang me about and another colleague, a fortnight ago. Look, Philip, I don't quite buy the idea of a trench. You can look at it and certainly say that Adelaide, metropolitan Adelaide, has a discernible western suburb, northern suburb, Labor heartland. But, if you go back to the 93 state bank election, it's a different picture. The trench can...
Just a moment. Let me explain that the trench are 11 marginal electorates in Adelaide.
And, to sum that up in a nutshell, there are 11 marginal seats at under 5 that Labor hold, 7 of those at under 3. And, going into seeking a fourth term is a pretty big ask for any government, frankly. And with that sort of electoral landscape, in front of you. You know, Labor, we're always going to battle to hold government in this election, but there's been a series of events over the last, well, really 3 years or so, and, you know, you could look at the Olympic Dam not going ahead, a huge blow to the confidence of the state and to a government that had really hung so much off. The multiplier effects that that great mine would produce, and the government spent a lot on infrastructure, that's now coming back to bite with some pretty heavy budget deficits, which of course hands a huge free kick to an opposition to point to a budget out of control, and of course the Liberals have made a great deal of that.
LNL on RN, and we're discussing the South Australian polls on our Election Watch segment, and my guests are Hayden Manning, and now back to Anthony Green. Key issues, Anthony. Holden pulls out. Employment is the focus. Thousands of people are about to be jobless. State budget so stretched that there's not much money to create more jobs. Which party do you think has the better solution to this intractably difficult problem?
Well, I think whoever wins the election, and it's likely to be the Liberals, is faced with a difficult 4 years because the Holden closures are still to come. We've only got the announcements so far. The problems are still to come in the next term of government. In the end, you can look at issues. What happens in the end is that most people tend to go on trust. Do they trust one side or the other? The current government has been there for 12 years. And over a decade or so, the tradition in Australia is governments tend to wear out their welcome, that they start to get the blame for issues that previously, in their first term, they could blame on the previous government. Over a decade, a government is suddenly responsible for everything. The problem the Labor Party has is it's been in office for 12 years. It has presided over the deficits. It hasn't seen Olympic Dam go ahead. The announcement has been made about Holden. For most people, the alternative government, the Liberal Party, only has to be credible, vaguely credible, to be a reasonable alternative after 12 years in office. We've seen that around the last few years, governments that have gone beyond the third term to their fourth term in New South Wales, in Victoria, and in Queensland, and on the same weekend this weekend in Tasmania, once they get into a fourth term, they start to become completely terminal in terms of what happens. And I think that's the problem the Labor Party faces, is this time is up.
Is there much enthusiasm, Anthony, for the incoming mob? Are people rushing to the polls, bursting with excitement, or is it simply Labor losing?
To an extent, it's the government losing. I mean, they weren't dancing on the street for the O'Farrell government being elected or the Newman government being elected. There was a lot of joy about kicking the old mob out. It's not going to be as drastic as that in South Australia, but there's a sense in which it's not very often that a government comes to office with people in rapture about it. Yeah. I mean, there was a bit too much rapture about Kevin Rudd coming to power, for instance, in 2007, and that proved not to be quite the rapture people expected. And I think in South Australia what you're seeing is what normally happens is eventually governments wear out their welcome, and at that point the opposition is welcome to come in and have its turn.
Hayden, the Liberal solution, and here we hear a faithful echo from the Abbott hockey song sheet, is to allow business to grow the economy and for the government to stay out of the way. Ideological rhetoric or plausible?
Oh, look, I think it's more on the rhetoric side of the ledger, Philip. Certainly, Marshall has outlined a series of tax cuts, but they're mainly about thresholds, the payroll and land tax. He's thrown in for good measure, affecting many people, council rates, a cap on council rates, but that just reflects...
Is it true what the Liberals say, that South Australia is the highest taxing state?
Look, when I've looked at reports on that, it is. Some of the taxes certainly around land tax are higher, significantly so. But overall, South Australia's always been going, it can go back to the Playford era of the 50s and 60s. We've had a Liberal Party very much involved in an active role in government in the economy. Marshall doesn't come from the economic rationalist or whatever, hard right of the Liberal Party at all. Basically, as Anthony said, he's trying to put up a plausible set of policies to say, I'm more aware of the budget deficit than Mr. Weatherall, the Premier. I'm concerned that the state's lost two credit rating. We've had two downgrades of the credit rating. I'm aware of that, voter. I'm going to do my best to rein that in. But along the way, I'm aware you're tired of paying high water bills, electricity. I'm going to try to address those issues. Trust me. I mean, that's what's on the plate. And I think most people are seeking and wanting a bit of a change and are on some faith here. We'll trust him.
Anthony, if there's one thing that can be observed in Australian politics of late is that we tend to exaggerate the problems. So while unemployment is at 6.6%, it's been a lot worse than that in the past, hasn't it?
Oh, it certainly has, although it's starting to fade into the memory of a lot of people. I mean, you're talking back to the 1990s when it was seriously bad. We've had a long period of growth, and even after the financial crisis, the newer flexibility in the workforce managed to sort of avoid the mass layoffs we saw in the past. What happened in 2008 bore no relationship to what I remember happening in the early 90s, when states like South Australia and Victoria were basket cases and true rust belts. There's been nothing like those sorts of layoffs, although you've got to wonder, with the end of the automotive industry, will that be a workforce that, like we saw in the early 1990s, found it very hard to switch to other sorts of jobs? The new jobs that come in don't necessarily employ the old workforce, and that's going to be the problem for South Australia, is some of the people who've got talent and skills might leave the state, and South Australia keeps getting stuck with the old ageing workforce. Same problem Tasmania continues to face.
Hayden, I think you want to respond to that.
Yes, I think the key for many in South Australia, in terms of the manufacturing, which doesn't fit Rust Belt, the high end of manufacturing, of which there are a lot of small industries, but including one whopping big one, and that's defence contracts. And the state's, part of the success of the early Rand government was to win contracts from the Commonwealth in rivalry, mainly with Victoria, to build the air warfare destroyer. That comes to a conclusion in the next couple of years, and there's this so-called valley of death where there's no new contract as we await to see what's going to happen with the submarine build. So that's one area of great concern, and I think the pressure on the Abbott government in coming years is going to be pretty big from, one expects the Marshall government to ensure that the state gets that. And the leverage there will be the situation with all the unemployed coming out of the Holden's factory. Just one thing I'd add, though, earlier about the notion of the Rust Belt state here. When Mitsubishi closed back about 4 years ago, there was a sense in the lead-up to that would be indicative of disaster. State took it in its stride pretty well, and the unemployment rate did not head up a great deal. But part of the picture there was the buoyancy around the supposed multiplier effects from the big mine up north. So this time around, Holden's will be a more severe closure than the Mitsubishi.
This is timely for me to remind the listener that our next story, also on jobs, is on the future of jobs. And the argument will be that the future does not belong to car workers or the low-skilled and poorly educated, but knowledge workers, designers, filmmakers, scientists and IT workers in these powerhouse cities. But let's stick with South Australia for the moment, because, Anthony, by no leap of the imagination could Adelaide be described as a powerhouse city.
No, and I think the interesting thing is to compare two other big centres which have been suffering from deindustrialisation, which is Newcastle and Geelong. The advantage that both of those have had is they're not too far away from the capital city of the state. And Newcastle in particular, with the closure of the steelworks, what it's sort of become is a sort of place where the jobs which people can't afford to live in Sydney and work in have ended up in Newcastle. There's been a lot of shift of jobs out of Sydney to Newcastle.
What sort of jobs, Anthony?
Oh, well, some of the government departments have moved offices up there. So, smaller manufacturing, smaller clerical, because it's too expensive for average workers to live in Sydney. Those sorts of jobs are driven out of Sydney by transport problems and the inability to pay the sorts of wages and be competitive. And Geelong's sort of attracting other sorts of jobs because, again, it's still near something. And the problem with Adelaide is that it can't compete in quite the same way. It's a long way away from the other cities. It doesn't have that closeness to a big centre to be able to be a cheaper alternative with a nice lifestyle. Now, certainly Adelaide has a nice lifestyle, but, I mean, you know, I've got friends who live in Newcastle. They've got the lifestyle I remember in Sydney from when I was a kid, when you can still get to the beach and there's still car parking, which doesn't exist in Sydney anymore. Adelaide's in a different state. You know, you've got to make a big move to get there. It's not going to be able to compete. It's now competing with cities like Geelong, which are suffering the same industrialisation.
I should make the point that I've always loved South Australia. I got involved in the place with Don Dunstan, and we're still rushing over to South Australia to work on various projects with RAN. And it is the most congenial of cities. Can it, in your view, Anthony, rise from its own ashes?
Well, it has to find something that it's its marketing point. I mean, you can't help but... Adelaide has still got that history of the Wakefield city, of all the different classes brought out to make a functioning society. It's got all these funny little class things, which are quite different from its perception of those. I mean, you were talking about the trench. Well, that's just simply that the Labor vote's high down at the port and it drops off as you go up the hills. And the city's always been laid out that way, with little pockets like Glenelg, which are a bit different. But it always strikes me that... there's always something about Adelaide which is different in terms of class and old class. There's an old class in Adelaide which is quite different from Sydney and Melbourne, and it goes all the way back to the roots of the colony. There's an establishment there which is different from Melbourne and Sydney.
And it has to be said, there have been times in South Australia's history when it was cutting edge, when it it was leading the world in political innovation. Votes for women come to mind. Hayden, you wrote recently that the RAN government weaved a narrative around regaining that AAA credit rating and ushering in a mining boom, which has since come undone. Quote, South Australia is falling behind other mainland states on all main economic measures. Are you that pessimistic?
Oh, I'm an optimist by nature, Philip, and I've lived here all my life. What I'm reflecting there is a sense of just how bad it was. As Anthony mentioned earlier, in South Australia during the 90s, when we had the state bank collapse, a huge debt burden, and we really were, you know, we were the mendicant state. You know, I'd go to the eastern states, and that's what you'd hear from former, you know, schoolmates and people you'd meet. We got out of that. I mean, the middle RAN years, there really was a sense of optimism, and RAN made much of that narrative around, I'll bring the state back to the AAA. He had to, because Labor had such a bad record, were blamed squarely for the state bank collapse. That's another story. I don't think they deserved all the blame, but that's another story. But the voters blamed them. Take that away, you know, whether or lost two credit ratings, you know, and I don't think people carry that around their, you know, the front of their brains, you know, the credit ratings drop, but it's a sense that it's a broken narrative. And then we have mentioned already, the dam is deferred. Olympic Dam Mine may still go ahead. You know, BHP are working on some fancy metallurgy to make it cheaper to, you know, process their copper. If they can crack that, then suddenly the tide may turn. So that'd be my optimistic note. Plus, of course, those defence contracts matter hugely. And then there are the natural strengths in an array of agricultural and tourist industries.
I must say, listening to you two blokes, my heart goes out to Stephen Marshall if he wins on Saturday. It could be a poison chalice, Anthony.
It could be. I mean, the number of jobs which will be lost could be quite, you know, what happens to those people, what other jobs can be found, is going to be a major problem. And, you know, in the middle of the last decade, when the whole country was booming, South Australia and Tasmania suddenly looked better than they'd been for decades. Well, as the economy's dipped down a bit, of course, those at the bottom have fared worse. And both states this weekend that are going to the polls are both feeling considerably at the bottom of the pile and the re-emergence of problems they thought had passed.
Gentlemen, we've got to wind it up. We've been talking to Anthony Green, who is, of course, Delphic Oracular, and he's the ABC's election analyst. And Dr. Hayden Manning is from the School of Social and Policy Studies at Flinders University. And as promised, we're going to get onto the future of jobs, and it may surprise you. I'll have two professors joining me, Philip O'Neill and Peter Gahan. The reason we're playing more music than usual is because I've actually got a live guest sitting opposite me, and it takes a little while to settle him in. But yes, as advertised, the future of jobs. I've already signalled one of the central ideas that that nations won't be creating as many jobs as in the past, but it'll be these new powerhouses. And the best jobs in the global mega cities are most emphatically not for car workers. The buzzwords and phrases for policymakers now are innovation, clusters — we've done some work on clusters previously on the program — and economic corridors. So to discuss the good, the bad and the ugly in this new urban economy, we welcome Professor Phil O'Neill from the University of Western Sydney. Phil used to be based in Newcastle, which you heard Anthony praising to the heavens, or at least to some extent, in our last story. He still writes a weekly column for the Newcastle Herald, and it's lovely to have him sitting with me in the Sydney studio. In Melbourne, Peter Gahan is Professor of Management at Melbourne Uni, and he's now Director of the Centre of Workplace Leadership at that university. Phil O'Neill, you've been quoted in a number of newspaper articles that highlight the good news on jobs in Australia. Okay, corridors, clusters, isn't that spin?
Oh, it's all spin, Philip, it's always spin. What we're seeing is that the spin in Sydney in particular is working quite remarkably. 5 years ago, we had a global financial crisis, and the latest figures show that on the back of that, that Sydney had a little bit of a hiccup, but not too much, and that the very much targeted professional services and creative workers, their areas of employment have grown considerably in the Sydney
economy.
But
that's a part of your thesis, isn't it, that while job growth is uneven, where it is occurring, it's huge.
Well, the success of the venture is enormous, where we see a deliberate attempt to concentrate pools of talent, the world's best people, and we put them in cities that have good infrastructure and good amenity, then jobs growth in Western Sydney is definitely taking place.
Peter, one of the political responses to the job losses in the car industry is that these unfortunate people would move or transition to better jobs. What's the chances of that?
Well, I think for some people, there will be opportunities arise in other parts of, say, the manufacturing sector, where there are skills that can be transferred from, say, the auto sector here in Melbourne into other parts of manufacturing. But certainly for a lot of other workers, it's going to be a far more difficult proposition to make that type of transition. Many of them are likely to move out into unrelated industries, more likely in some type of service provision as opposed to making goods. Other workers will find, in fact, there's a structural hole for them such that they'll find transition difficult and in some cases impossible.
Peter, we're talking about living, breathing human beings, and when they lose their jobs, they tend to a total collapse in self-confidence, a sense of despair. It's very hard to rehabilitate people who feel that they've been rejected, ejected, and that they don't have a future.
Absolutely, and I suppose the experience from previous periods of recession and restructuring have highlighted this enormously. We go back to the 1990s when there was a lot of microeconomic reform and restructuring generally, again in the manufacturing sector. We saw many workers, particularly men who were older, being displaced from their jobs, and many of them never found work again and were in effect hidden through disability, pensions and a range of other welfare arrangements, which were designed to accommodate those types of workers. It can also have huge impacts for particular areas as well where these jobs tend to be concentrated. So the prospects for Geelong, for example, I think probably will accommodate many of the changes, but there'll be many workers in the auto sector and also in businesses outside of the auto sector directly that service different parts of that industry, you know, where there are going to be serious problems which those types of workers will face.
Phil O'Neill, have you observed this in Newcastle?
Well, what was said in the earlier segment, Philip, is exactly right. That Newcastle is very lucky that it's not where Adelaide is. Adelaide has the great sandy desert at its back and the great southern ocean at its front. Newcastle is on the doorstep of Sydney, and that the Sydney-Brisbane corridor is one of the fastest growing population growth corridors in the world. And if you want to be where a city in the world that has to undertake an industrial restructuring, Newcastle would be the place you'd pick.
Peter, labour market deregulation, is that going to be a big help?
Well, I think the evidence doesn't suggest a strategy of labour market deregulation is going to be a big driver for direct foreign investment. It's certainly not necessarily going to lead to the structural adjustments that is often lauded as an important part of that type of approach. I don't think there's a great deal of evidence to show that that's really the primary policy response that it will be effective. We'll be looking at a range of other things.
Well, let's look beyond this stuff and let's get excited. Phil O'Neill, clusters, corridors. Much of this can be traced to a very influential book called The New Geography of Jobs by an Italian, Enrico Moretti. Tell us about Moretti.
Well, he has an Italian name, and probably like all good Americans, he's a migrant to America. And he's an economist and an economic geographer at the University of California. And that's a great place in the world to observe industrial change over the last 50 years. He took a year off and he decided that he would like to say something at large about this problem of jobs creation and generation from the point of view of California, very much so. But he's taken up with the very much the buzzword in the United States that cities are assembling talent pools, that the great industrial cities of the post-war period around the Great Lakes and the Midwest are actually losing their talented people, and those people are congregating in new urban economies.
And Moretti is a big believer that success breeds success and that you have a multiplier effect.
And the opposite will occur, that if you don't have success, that people will leave your city and go to the place where they can find productive work.
Phil, I understand that his maxim or his equation is that one knowledge worker creates five other jobs.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting thing.
A look of scepticism passed over your face then.
It does. I mean, he quotes an example of a bookbinder in San Francisco who claims that his orders for leather-covered books follows the Western United States economic performance. It's a bit romantic. I think what we're observing is that in Western economies, the advantage now lies with those people who hold very high-order skills, and where we get concentrations of those high-order skills, whether it's in San Francisco or Sydney, then firms will invest in those people because they do very competitive things.
We have to mention Silicon Valley, but I understand that you see something interesting happening around us here in Ultimo.
Well, the latest figures from the Sydney of City show that the big professional services firms in finance and law that are in the big buildings across the way here are doing very successfully. But Sydney City Council has been very clever in holding back that development from the Ultimo-Pyrmont region and from the southern side and the Surry Hills area. What they've allowed is a lot more smaller, innovative firms to take footholds there, perhaps with lower rents, but to tap in, and this is important, into the same thick labour pool. And so the best and the brightest, not just from around Australia, but in many parts of the world, are able to get good visas into Sydney And we find media companies, tech startups and so on, now emerging in the Pyrmont Ultimo area and generating jobs.
Peter, Phil has talked about global cities with huge populations having a competitive advantage in attracting new jobs. What about places in Australia that don't have the population advantage? And, of course, both Tasmania and Adelaide come to mind.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, I think in both those cases, there are, I suppose, other pathways to success and rejuvenation. And I think it centres around natural endowment. So that's the other part of the equation here, is the fact that centres will often develop specialisation and a capacity to be very productive and to grow, because not just they've got certain human capital attributes, but also because they have other sources of competitive advantage through natural endowments.
It's interesting, isn't it, that we can see a demonstration of the theory in that extraordinary art gallery in Hobart, created by one of the most eccentric people in Australia, which has galvanised the place. It's electrified that, not only that part of Tasmania, but Tasmania in its totality.
Well, and I think so. And I think the other element here is the role of governments, not in terms of hard written law types of regulation, but if you like, sort of more innovative forms of intervention which are designed to facilitate these types of developments. And again, I think there have been some interesting developments in Tasmania as well as other states where, and the example of Sydney and Ultimo, I think, was an interesting case of where governments, local and state governments, can play a critical role in sort of steering the way that development happens. And
well, that's a terribly important issue to look at and discuss, because, of course, the neocons, the conservatives, don't think government's got any role. Its role is to just get out of the way. What do you think, Phil O'Neill?
Well, in Moretti's book, he said the number one issue is government investment in higher education. These things don't happen in a vacuum. They happen most likely where there is a high proportion of the working population that actually have been to university. I was looking at some figures the other day. 40% of inner London workers now are foreign born, and those workers are twice as likely to hold degrees as your average London born worker. Sydney workforce at the moment is in excess of 60% of people hold higher education degrees. You only have to go 20 kilometres west of here and it drops below 20%.
And yet, again and again, we hear some conservatives saying we are over-educating. We're producing too many graduates. They can't be accommodated.
Well, I mean, the national target under Labor was 40% of 25 to 34-year-olds should hold a degree. That's still 60% of the working population to have all sorts of other qualifications. The point about Moretti, which I think is very important to Australia, and it comes into play in the Hobart and Adelaide context, is what you don't want is the best and brightest to continually leave Adelaide and Hobart. Mm. What that means is that currently Hobart and Adelaide are very much underperforming in terms of that group of the labour force that hold higher education degrees. Now, it's one thing to actually have natural assets, but unless you actually have the best and the brightest able to work, then firms won't invest in those places.
This is LNL on RN, and we're looking at the future of jobs with Professors Philip O'Neill and Peter Gahan. Peter, are you as persuaded as Philip is about the virtues and merits of government involvement?
Well, I think in the form that we were talking about before, it's critical for the way that particular regions are able to develop. I mean, the reality is also when we have these, if you like, what's often referred to as skill-based technological change, it doesn't mean that, in fact, all jobs that are created are high-skilled jobs. You know, when we have jobs in high-tech sectors or value-added manufacturing, they still go to cafes, they still need to get their haircuts and so on. So you still have quite a spectrum of jobs that tend to get created around these high-skilled jobs. For many of those sorts of workers, where their wages are at the bottom end of the wage distribution, there are often lots of social issues which arise for them in terms of their location, which tends to be further away from the centre centres of production and so on. So it does require governments to do a whole range of things, both in terms of planning for those types of developments, facilitating them to move in particular directions, but also to deal with many of the downsides that are associated with that type of growth.
Well, let's look at one of the things that governments around the world would like to do if they thought they could politically get away with it. There's much discussion about it, and that is raise the retirement age. Now, what's that going to do if it comes about, Philip O'Neill?
Well, there's two reasons you could do that. You could do it to relieve the burden on the federal budget of old age pensions.
That's the driving force.
Well, yeah. That's not particularly a good idea for an economic reason. Keeping the old, skilled, educated worker in the workforce as your motivation, well, that does correspond to a talent-driven economic strategy.
So, Peter, it's we're not looking at an ageist philosophy here. There is a role for the older worker in this brave new world you're describing.
No, absolutely. And I think the whole issue of skill transfer and a whole range of, if you like, non-technical skills which go with this are very important. In some areas, some occupations, there are ongoing issues of labour supply, and obviously drawing on older workers who want to remain in the workforce becomes a very important means by which labour supply is augmented. Having said that, it's not sort of clear from the evidence that a lot of firms are embracing this type of strategy. It presents particular problems for a lot of firms in terms of any types of adjustments in the way that workplaces are configured, different types of working arrangements and so on, are such that sometimes the transaction costs can make this unattractive. So it's not clear yet from the evidence that we've got a great deal of traction from a lot of firms utilising this type of strategy.
Places like San Francisco, London, Rio and Sydney, or certain areas, are doing really well. I'd like to ask you, Philip, tell me what's happening in Rio. I didn't realise that Rio was one of these energising cities.
One of the things that's common, Philip, is the ability to attract young, qualified labour. And what we're seeing, I think, for the first time in history, is that, well, we do have an increasingly mobile world, and people are making two decisions. They want to be, obviously, where they can be prosperous. But increasingly, their value systems are such that they want to be in a city that has amenity. And by amenity, we mean that city has a positive environmental outlook and that it has a positive social outlook.
It's a bit hard to apply that to Rio.
Well, if you're
it's dominated by the favelas.
But if you're Portuguese background or in a place in the vast country called Brazil, then the place that you are most likely to find that is in Rio rather than some of the other Brazilian cities.
Why is San Francisco the model city in the US? One would have thought that what you're describing would be more applicable to, say, Manhattan.
Well, Manhattan, of course, is the other one. It probably took Giuliani and Bloomberg and others to clean it up a bit so that the hipsters and other young professionals would migrate there. You have to realise in the US that this is a country of 300 million people. So it is possible to remain in your nation, migrate out of a Detroit or an Idaho city or so on, and then move across to San Francisco and be very competitive and quite prosperous in what is a fairly thick labour market in
Peter,
terms of
Peter,
sales.
I want to believe what you blokes are telling me, but I keep vaguely seeing a future which looks like Blade Runner, you know, a megacity with pockets of wealth surrounded by extreme poverty and desolation. Is that the future for some Australian cities?
Well, it might be somewhere in between. I mean, again, San Francisco's a really interesting example. It's an amazing place. It's full of all sorts of growth industries. It's part of a much larger Bay Area and beyond, where we're seeing new industries spawning in relatively short periods of time, creating enormous wealth. But they're also coming with fairly significant problems of poverty as well. With that, I suppose, a whole range of social issues which governments to varying degrees are trying to deal with and in some respects not always successfully. So I think you do get always, if you like, this underbelly that often comes with this rapid development of large cities. So it's not all beer and chocolates, and it tends to be the case that some people get the beer and chocolates, others don't.
We haven't mentioned India and we haven't mentioned China. Mm. Philip, is there any way in which China is plugging into your theory?
Well, China's interesting. I mean, a lot of what we're talking about is the loss of a mass production industrial logic or rationale. And one of the reasons we're losing that is that China has assembled a very effective mass production logic based upon low labour costs and increasingly on manufacturing innovation at a scale that the world has never seen before. Simultaneously, we're actually seeing, particularly in Shanghai and Beijing, the development of their own high-skilled, young, professional, urban elite. And Shanghai is a good example of the type of city that China is generating, which would probably be a match for America's New York or in Australia, in Sydney's case. So China is a bit of a hand on both of these economic strategies.
And, Peter, there were times when high education around India did energise the Indian economy and give it a high-tech cutting edge.
Well, that's true, and I think to a degree that remains the case. And we're seeing similar trends, probably with different types of configurations happening in India as have now been described for China. I think that's what makes some of these newly developing countries, these big high-growth economies, really interesting in that they're able to both develop these low-cost, low-wage type elements, but also develop these high-end, high-skill, high-value-add sectors. And again, often
I have to wind it up and thank you for adding value to our program. Professor Philip O'Neill, Director of Urban Research Centre at the University of Western Sydney, and Professor Peter Gahan, who's Professor of Management at the Director Centre for Workplace Leadership at the University of Melbourne. On our next, Bruce Shapiro will be joining us, as he does most Tuesdays, and I'll be talking to American author and journalist Howard Bloom. His latest book, Dark Invasion, looks at a German espionage operation in the United States during World War I. And I'd like to welcome Paul back to the program. Paul, it's great to see you on the other side of that great big sheet of glass. This was LNL on RN. Please stick around now for the news.